A song is Let the Spirit Take Over. Music from Denise Davis at about 13 minutes past the hour on this Broken Road Radio Thursday morning. Good morning to you. My name is Jim Park, and David Allen Punt is in the newsroom, and our resident Norwegian Gisle Sørli with us this morning, but a little under the weather. He will croak good morning here. Good morning, Gisle.
Good morning. Good morning.
Voice a little
they
rough
broke
today.
Through the matrix. Not even Ludafix can branches protecting me from the bugs.
Well, you got to spread some of that Brunost on your chest, I think. I think that's the old home remedy. Joining us also this morning, a very special guest. His name is Bill Hook. He's the Associate Executive Director and the Senior Policy Fellow with American Meteorological Society, with a group that's been around since 1919. And Bill, when I hear 1919, I think of root beer, I think of the Black Sox scandal, and now I can think of the American Meteorological Society. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you guys, and it's a real pleasure to join you.
And our subject today is stewardship. Of course, Gisle always either discusses the topic from his own resources, or he finds good friends to come on with us, and we're grateful that Bill had time. Bill, where are you? Are you in Alexandria?
I am indeed. Okay. I'm here in my home, which is halfway between Old Town Alexandria and George Washington's home of Mount Vernon, down the road a little bit.
Okay, so you can look toward D.C. and see this great cloud of confusion then that hangs over that time.
Not only that, I go into that great cloud of confusion and help it get even more confused every day. So.
Now, we had a kind of a poignant question this morning. Do you know Lois Lerner, Bill?
I do not.
Okay. Do you know what she looks like? Is she a fairly tall gal?
I have no idea. I heard you guys talking about her earlier. I have no idea who she is. That's how.
Okay.
Yeah, she was the IRS official that was in charge of handing out tax-free status for certain groups. And there's some groups that she liked and some groups she didn't like.
Oh, you're not going to draw me into that morass.
No. I was just
wondering if she would fit a standard orange jumpsuit. I'm just not sure.
If she would fit into a standard orange jumpsuit and cuffs, or we'd have to have something made especially for her. You know, if they can get something off the rack, you know, so much the better.
Well, you know, I think part of what the station stance is that all of us deserve that orange jumpsuit or worse.
And, yes. Oh, yeah.
Thanks to the God's grace, we're all allowed to wear different outfits.
Excellent point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I wonder, I don't know if Lois has got the same deal going with the Ways and Means Committee. I'm not sure. I'm not. They may not have the same rules, but we'll see.
I've been reading a little bit of background on the American Meteorological Society. What is it that you do as an organization, Bill?
Okay, that's a great question. So it's a professional society. We have about 15,000 members. Most of them are people like me. They're atmospheric scientists, or they're oceanographers or hydrologists worrying about river flows and things like that. 10% of the members are broadcast meteorologists. They're the men and women that you see on television every evening.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of them are Weather Service members. They work for the National Weather Service in the 150 offices across the country. And we have a lot of members who work for companies like the Weather Channel and AccuWeather, and for other private sector firms like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Grumman, Ball Aerospace, companies that build the weather satellites and the radars and all the equipment that we depend on. We're international. We have a lot of international members. And we're all about the business of keeping people worldwide safe from weather hazards and able to take advantage of weather's benefits and protecting the environment.
So you're telling me it takes people to produce a forecast, not just a computer model.
That would be correct. And certainly in 1919, when we were founded, there were no computers. There were no weather satellites. There were no radars. And yet, if you look at the logo from around that year, it says, gee, we think we can help people with public health and with agriculture and maritime navigation and aerial navigation, they called it then, and commerce. And we made good on that forecast. You know, that was a pretty brave forecast to make before we had any tools. And today, people really rely on the weather.
Is there anything today going on meteorologically that is truly unusual, out of the ordinary?
That's a great question, and you see arguments on both sides of that in the papers every day. And of course, weather is highly variable. You know, all of us remember growing up, and particularly if you've got 70 years under your belt the way I do, you've seen pretty much what you'd call every kind of winter, every kind of summer, and different places in the country and so on. There's so much variability that the detection of the kind of change you're talking about in the presence of that year-to-year stuff is very difficult. And again, there's some arguments. We're certainly seeing climate change, even in the middle of all that signal, human-induced climate change. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of natural variability going on as well.
Well, that was my next question. Is to what degree are humans responsible for what happens with the weather?
Okay, so the answer is we certainly have a fair responsibility for the warming of the climate. We're putting in a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere every year, more than the oceans are able to absorb, and the oceans are warming up and acidifying as a result of that and so on. All of that science is pretty much beyond dispute, but what you'll see, you know, those are the things that have happened so far. What you see going forward is obviously a little more uncertain. It's going to vary from place to place. And our big problem is we're not doing very well with the environmental challenges we have now. We need to get a little better at being resilient to extremes day to day. When we do that, we'll find out we've gotten better with respect to the extremes that are coming over the next century.
Now, are you talking about pollution specifically?
No, I'm talking about pollution. I'm talking about hurricanes and winter storms.
Okay,
and
the effects of it all then, the weather events themselves. Yeah. So we can expect more extreme weather, you're saying?
We can expect certainly continuing extreme weather, and as climate varies, the patterns of extreme, the climate is basically the sum of extremes. The Earth is doing its business through these extreme events. So if you have an average precip someplace, say in the tropics, it turns out that hurricanes contribute about 30% to that average. And they're very noisy year to year, so you can get great fluctuations in tropical rainfall just from the hurricanes. And the same thing applies to winter storms up in the latitudes where we all live.
Mm-hmm.
So key question then, do I need to burn my cross-country skis? Or
you know, if you're going to keep getting respiratory infections, you might need to burn your cross-country skis, but... I just can't picture a Norwegian without skis at hand.
Right.
There seems to be something that would just be so culturally wrong with that. That right. No, I think you need to hang on to them. There are some people that say we might even get when we get snow, we'll get heavier snows and so on.
Well, that would delight Gisela. Yeah.
Teach your kids how to do that, Gisela.
All right.
Well, Bill, what kind of tools do we possess then as a society or a culture or as a human race to deal with these things? How do we, you know, we're all called to be stewards of God's, yep. of God's earth. It's always impressed me as an individual mandate, you know, we're responsible for our own actions individually to take care of the earth. How do we get together as a group, as a state, as a nation, as a culture, as a race to tend to those matters?
Well, that's a great question, and I've heard some of the discussions you all have had on the air about the roles of government and so on, and certainly for as long as we can remember, there have been, history really goes back to city-states that formed, you know, as soon as people stopped being nomadic and started settling in towns and doing agriculture and so on, they realized they had to work out a lot of these issues, so once we got past sort of family units, this question of tribes and building up some kind of structure to govern us has always been important. From a Christian standpoint, one of the problems here is a spiritual problem. Those government, all those laws, all those frameworks, all those rules are an effort to... Well, let's take the U.S. Constitution, for example. The founding fathers realized that people act in their self-interest. And so they said, how can we set up a framework of rules so when everyone acts in his or her self-interest, the natural thing to do, The aggregate, when you add it all together, it'll be sort of for the public good. And all these checks and balances and all the other structure of the Constitution have done a pretty good job for 200 years of getting us in that direction. But at the heart of it, there's still a trust issue and a spiritual issue. You and I individually have to be responsible. We have to be trustworthy. And then, instead of pointing fingers at each other and saying, oh, you're not trustworthy and you're not responsible or whatever, we've got to find a lot of grace, a lot of forgiveness to bring in there. And the as our numbers grow, that becomes more and more important. I think it's the biggest challenge that we face. It's not a technological challenge. It's not even a challenge of some of these social issues of living in cities and so on. The key issue is getting the spiritual framework right. And it's the one issue that people don't like to face. You know, I have a lot of scientist friends. There are a lot of scientists, who are Christian, but they're sort of a smaller, Christians are a smaller minority of scientists than some other groups like business or whatever. Trying to do this without dealing with some spiritual issues. They keep saying, oh, we don't need those, and yet it sure looks to me like we do.
We've had, you know, kind of this discussion a little bit in the last couple of weeks, and there are some who would say that education particularly went off the rails like in the 1840s, where it started. It slowly came to the point where parents individually decided that they would give educating their children over to the state. There was probably even an earlier point, maybe the late 18th century, early 19th century, where people started thinking that they would be a better decider or a better judge of what is in their best interest rather than their creator. And it's gone downhill ever since. This pace of secularism and belief that we know better has picked up steam a lot in the last 50 or 60 years. I think maybe the fewer and fewer Christians in the scientific community is just a symptom of, and I would say political community as well. Are you hopeful for the rest of the world or for this country in the semi-near term, 40 years, 50 years?
Absolutely.
Really, and why?
Oh, gosh, I hardly know where to begin. So let's take the problem from two standpoints. One would be the standpoint of real-world tools that are available to us that weren't available even a generation ago. And I see three or four of those. One is a basis of facts. So for really most of human experience, people thought three things. They thought the climate never changed. They thought the assimilative capacity of the atmosphere was infinite. You could put as much junk into the atmosphere as you wanted. It wouldn't matter. And they thought weather was unpredictable. And in just the last 100 years, we haven't just tweaked those ideas. We've turned each of them on its head. So we know the climate is a variable, always has been, sometimes abruptly so. We know that you can't keep putting junk in the atmosphere. It's not just a local regional problem. We've now, with 7 billion people, we've managed to make it a global problem. And weather is a lot more predictable than we used to think. So a basis of facts, sort of learning how things work, and we're rapidly accumulating science, not just on the weather and climate and the oceans, but also on ecosystems and habitat and the way the whole surface of the earth and its 7 billion people fit together. Second one is the policy framework. And there if you look at the national level, you see gridlock. But as a result of that gridlock, what you see in every country, not just the U.S., but a lot of local place-based initiatives. And so people are doing things locally to try to deal with the environment as something to be protected, as a threat from time to time, and also as a resource that we really depend on. They're doing these things, whether it's in Asheville, North Carolina, or Peoria, or Boulder, Colorado, or Oslo. They're doing these things. Third thing is, this is made possible. All this local networking, all this local place-based stuff works because of social networks. We're talking on just such a phenomenon. I mean, when I was a kid, the only radio stations were the ones that broadcast, and there were darn few of them. And this is just a wonderful technology. So there's so many ways you and I can look over our shoulder at what's going on in the adjacent community and say, oh, they're really successful there. They're really failing there. So we've got a basis of facts. We've got policies. We've got social networking. And I do think the fourth tool is, I deal a lot with young scientists, young leaders, and a lot of those young scientists are people of faith, by the way. But unlike my generation, where we sort of saw support as an entitlement, you know, give us lots of money and don't ask too many questions and one day you'll be glad you did, and we kind of delivered on that. But the younger scientists I work with really want to make the world a better place. They're just so high-minded, so those four things in just the terms that you would come, you'd see that if just picking up the newspapers or watching TV. There's also the God's grace part of it, which is pretty strong in my mind. You and I operate on this idea that God made Noah a promise that he wasn't going to destroy the world again, in the 12th century, Europeans thought they were running out of wood. They thought it was sort of the end of things. And then they started burning coal, things worked out. In the 17th, 18th century, 19th century, they thought population was just unsustainable. And yet we've had a couple of 100 years of really rapid population growth since then, and technology and so on. So there's always been a kind of grace of God, a providential supply of technology and science and resources that has made things sort of work out so far.
Well, I certainly think God has got to be a huge part of the formula, but I'm thinking, what kinds of things can we do as human beings now? Do we need to get beyond fossil fuels, for example? How about slow foods in that movement, getting back to just pure foods grown locally as opposed to corporate farming? And it seems to me it boils down to dollars versus spirit. Again, if the choice is to build this factory so that we can employ 6,000 people, even though it pollutes, who makes that decision and on what basis? We've got to be able to make those judgments, and I'm not sure we're capable of doing that.
It sort of varies from person to person, though, doesn't it? So some people are trying to, do some of the things the old-fashioned way and the inexpensive and so on. But there's a lot of creativity and innovation out there. It's kind of like if the dinosaurs had been discussing with each other in the late Cretaceous, that have looked at mammals and said, wow, a new source of food, but in fact, the mammals were the critters of the future. The meteor hit, it was the mammals who survived. Going back to those ants, the ants have been around 100 million years.
Start with the ants again, because we were talking about that off the air. Tell us about the ants.
Okay, so if you look at an ant hill, for example, it solves these three basic problems that we're trying to solve as a human race. It manages to take advantage of the earth as a resource. The food that the ants need comes into the ant hill. It takes care of the water they need and so on. They take care of the environmental protection part. They've got a way of getting waste out of the ant hill and so on. The conditions in the ant hill are just about perfect, temperature, humidity, and they have a They keep out the predators and all the rest of it. But there's no ant you can accuse of having the big picture. So something in that simple ant coding is telling them sort of moment by moment, hey, take this speck of dirt out of the anthill. Leave this speck of dirt where it is, because if you pull this one out, the whole thing will collapse. Somehow, through the little simple chemical signals they're able to give each other and constantly talking, they solve all of... And when they find food outside the hill, they leave a little chemical trace, and they all know how to get to it, follow the ant in front of them and so on, and get to it and improve the path and all those things. And human beings, when you look at the 7 billion of us in aggregate, we're starting to mimic that. I'm a meteorologist, and meteorologists have actually been doing that for years with weather prediction. We've got three equations that we've got to solve simultaneously. And the equations really are insoluble. So what do? We approximate them with fifth grade arithmetic. And because that doesn't work very well, every few hours we have to reinitialize our models. And we break up the calculation into millions of cells all over the surface of the Earth and so on. So we're kind of ant-like in our approach to building a weather forecast. And similarly, if you look around the planet, you see some sort of ant-like. 7 billion people are, again, clusters of little solutions here and there, and just trying things out and feeling their way and seeing what looks like it's starting to work and following that, or something starting to fail and they give up on that. And it's very similar. So when the Bible says consider the ant a sluggard, you know, most of that is about being lazy, but there's a lot more we can learn from the ant.
You know, that reminds me of the free market system. I mean, that we work on here, just in the realm of economics. It's meant to absorb errors and mistakes, and operates on the faith that the greater good will be accomplished because everybody's acting in their own self-interest. What happens when you vest authority and power in a central unit, whether it's a government or a United Nations or a scientific organization or somebody who also has the power to do what they're invested to do? That is a little scary to me.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because, you know, we've seen examples in U.S. history, certainly, when, the capital, the free market system is just ideal for sort of making these things work, but it occasionally leads to imbalances. You know, you look at, it's sort of like playing Monopoly the way I used to with my brother and kid I thought was our best friend. And my brother and our best friend, their first order of business usually was to wipe me out and then finish the game, you know, duking it out among the two of them.
And how like life that is.
That's right. I think the free market system is great. It generates wealth and somehow, but somehow, and we're actually doing this worldwide. If you look, the statistics support this. We've got to take that poorest class and sort of see if we can bring them up to middle class. And through capitalism in places like India and China, even, despite, you know, some of the efforts, you might say, of their governments and so on, that's actually happening. You know, poverty is really declining as a fraction of people worldwide.
David?
Yeah, I had my mic off.
Uh-oh.
The I'm going to back up with just a little bit, Bill. The you talked about, you know, making great gains as far as dealing with pollution and the, you know, the kind of the byproduct of this capitalistic system we've got. One of the areas that of the world that's, you know, that's having severe problems is China.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah, there are places where people have difficulty breathing.
Yeah.
You know, every day. I mean, there are times when you can't see buildings that are, you know, a mile away.
Right.
And I'm not sure what my question is. How would you, in those, you know, the Chinese don't buy into the sustainability formulas and the ideas that that they're causing severe damage to their area or the world or the planet?
Yeah. That's marvelous. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, a wonderful thing is happening in China. It's so bad. And there are 3 million people who die every year because of air pollution, and a million of them are in China. So the problem is really focused there. And for their leaders, it's a huge domestic problem. So when they look, and now that they've got social media and so on, and people, they try in China to suppress a lot of that stuff, but the information is out there and people are complaining. U.S. Embassy was actually keeping track of particulates and so on, and blogging on that, and the Chinese were picking that up. The leaders, they like to sort of have this top-down command and control society, but they realize their biggest security threat is not the U.S., it's their, 1 billion people who are frustrated by things like this and other problems with the Chinese system. And so there's huge pressure. I mean, their biggest concern now is trying to find a soft landing, without having some big fraction of these 1 billion people sort of rise up against them. And they actually, when you look at the numbers, they are reducing the energy intensity of their economy. That is, the dependence of their economy on burning fossil fuels and so on, faster than any other country in the world.
What I'm hearing, Bill, is that you can't really silence the people. You can't suppress knowledge.
Funny how that works.
It is. It is. We're talking with Bill Hook, Senior Policy Fellow with the American Meteorological Society. And how does this boil down to the individual? What can we do as individuals to aid in the cause?
Boy, that's a great question. There's a quote by Gandhi who just has a Christian message in it. It's one of my favorite quotes. He said, "Be the change that you want to see in the world." And I think that's the heart of the spiritual problem for all of us. So in other words, I shouldn't say, gee, Dave, or gee, Jim, or whatever, you all ought to cut back on your energy consumption. You ought to get a hybrid car, or you ought to get the right light bulbs, or you ought to downsize your home, or whatever. Our duty is not to stand on our rights. It's to sort of to love, to model the kind of behavior that we want to see. And, again, going back to meteorologists, we have something in our field that we call the butterfly effect. Do you guys know?
Yeah, I've heard of that. In fact, I learned that from a meteorologist. Explain that, though.
The atmosphere is so, it's what they call a chaotic system, and a little disturbance in it makes a big change over a few weeks. So the idea, there was a scientist named Ed Lorenz at MIT who discovered this and coined the phrase, the flapping of a butterfly's wing over Africa can create a hurricane over the U.S. 3 weeks later. Now the butterfly is not mindful of what it's doing. It doesn't know whether it's flapping its wings and creating a hurricane or shutting one down. But we have a little more a situational awareness of that. And so there's this idea in meteorology that small changes can have a big effect. And that means that individuals can do the same thing. So you have a guy like St. Francis of Assisi, and he sort of said this. He said, proclaim the gospel, and if necessary, use words. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was, he wasn't thinking to himself, I'm going to change the world, as such. He thought, I'm going to change myself. God and I are going to work together. One of your radio shows here recently, you're just playing the song about... God writing the story of us all.
Mm-hmm.
And each of us is in the process of, we don't know whether we're going to be the hero or the villain of our story. But God is writing, the book of Dave and the book of Jim and the book of Gisela and Bill and Jane and Pedro and everybody else you can think of. And through, if we focus on being our best, getting in touch with the better angels of our nature, as it were, that'll be the biggest driver towards creating a world of the future that we all want to live in. And so it really is, at its heart, it's an individual matter. We have to conquer our desire to complain about everything else that's going on and focus on connecting with the kingdom of God inside us, and then projecting that, drawing our strength from that, and just sharing that with everyone around us.
You know, and I think that kind of goes back to Christ's instruction to his disciples too, that it's a matter of each of us being a disciple. And if we're all doing that, then discipleship will follow as a matter of course, which is to say, model the life. You don't have to instruct others, simply model the life, take care of what you have responsibility for, and the rest should fall into place. Accurate?
Amen. I just think, discipleship is more than just being saved. It's sort of looking at Jesus and looking at other role models and saying, you know, I think I'd like to be like Jesus.
It's ironing out your own wrinkles, I think. I think it really is.
And you've kind of alluded to it, but in your organization, how many are of same mind as you are, as far as Christianity, as far as believing in a creator, as far as accepting this same notion that you're talking about? Let us change from within. Let us change ourselves, and begin the grand revolution, or the bring about something that's more positive. How many are you the lone voice in the wilderness, or are you leading the parade?
Neither of those. Okay. One of the things about ants is it's very hard to find who's leading the parade. You see similar things when birds flock, that wonderful pattern that they make swirling around and so on. It turns out that no bird is always in the lead. There's not one bird that's in charge. It's the whole flock that's doing it. So I'm certainly not in charge. There are no statistics. The American Meteorological Society is blind, value neutral when it comes to people's faith or their spiritual stance, and for good reason, I think. Our focus is on, hey, let's do a better job of the science and the technology. So, but my guess is that, if we were to walk down, this, just going through your neighborhood, when you talk with people about these things and you talk about them in the way we've been the last 10 or 15 minutes, you're going to get agreement, particularly on the whole question of how we impact others. You can put it in the frame of reference of your kids. We all know that if you're loving and warm and encouraging and so on, guess what? Our kids turn out that way. Mm-hmm. And if we're abusive or exploitative or any of those things, gosh, our kids will have a little bit of that in them too. So I would say that our group is, it's got every persuasion. And we've got 15,000 members and 15,000 opinions.
And, of course, there's a website. In fact, I see you're associated with a couple of websites. There is the American Meteorological site, and we'll link to that in our podcast, by the way, for you listening. If you'd like to find out more about the organization, there'll be a link on our podcast later today. But also Living on the Earth? Living on the Real World.
Living on the Real World.
Tell us about that.
A blog where I discuss all of these things that we've been discussing. And as I said, I've written a book that kind of summarizes the things we've been discussing as well. It's got the same title. And you find all of that if you just Google William Hook or any of the links that you all are kind enough to put up.
Okay, well, we will certainly do that. And we've been enjoying the company of Bill Hook this morning. Bill, again, the Associate Executive Director and Senior Policy Fellow with the American Meteorological Society. And Gisli, thanks so much for introducing us to Bill. It's been a delight today.
Yeah, Bill. There's a lot of Scandinavians listening to us today, and our favorite country to talk about is Norway, of course. And what is Norway doing in this conversation?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, meteorology owes so much to the Norwegian School of Meteorology. They developed the whole nomenclature of fronts and so on because they discovered this concept of weather fronts during World War I, when fronts were a big deal. And the Bergen School has just been profoundly influential in the whole course of meteorology over the last 100 years. So I mentally salute every time I see you, Gisla.
Yeah, I think you've just made Gisla's day here.
I had no idea.
Bill, we'll talk to you again. I hope we can get you back here in a short time. And cover, there's a lot to cover with you. You're a brilliant guy, and we certainly thank you for your time this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Music continues now from the Ralph Carmichael Orchestra.